Welcome to our podcast series, Maintaining Healthy Nutrition in Pediatric IBD Patients. During this series, we will discuss the important role that diet plays in the management of IBD, focusing on maintenance of good nutrition, enteral nutritional therapy, as well as the specific carbohydrate diet. You will hear from medical professionals as well as two parents who have firsthand experience implementing enteral nutritional therapy and the specific carbohydrate diet. This series is sponsored by the NASPGHAN Foundation for Children's Digestive Health and Nutrition Foundation, along with the North American Society for Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition. A special thank you to the Woodward Crohn's and Colitis Foundation for providing support for this series. I'm Dr. Lindsay Albenberg, chair of the program and a pediatric gastroenterologist at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Today's podcast focuses on the specific carbohydrate diet. Our faculty today are myself, along with Kimberly Brawley, a clinical pediatric dietitian based at Seattle Children's Hospital. And we are going to be talking about a hot topic in IBD therapy, the specific carbohydrate diet. This is something Kim has a lot of experience with. And I'll just sort of briefly mention, in general, inflammatory bowel disease and what does diet have to do with it anyway? So, you know, we know that inflammatory bowel disease develops because of a combination of a person's genetics and also other environmental factors. So just having the genes is not enough. And when we think about the GI tract itself, the major environmental factors to which the gut is exposed are the things that we eat, so diet, and the bacteria and other microbes that live in our guts. And, you know, it would seem that diet would be something that is potentially modifiable and could be an attractive target for inflammatory bowel disease therapy. We also know that it seems that there are certain dietary patterns that occur in parts of the world where inflammatory bowel disease is more common. It seems that IBD may be associated with westernization and consumption of a more Western diet, and that IBD may be associated similarly with diets that are higher in animal fat and protein and lower in fiber. And so because of this, this has become a really interesting research topic, and researchers have started to study exclusion diets for the treatment of IBD, and the specific carbohydrate diet is just one example of an exclusion diet which has been promoted for IBD therapy. So I'm sure everyone is wondering, and Kim, you can enlighten us, so what is the SCD anyway?
Yeah, the specific carbohydrate diet is definitely one that's on the rise of interest in amongst the IBD community. It was actually first implemented by a pediatrician in the early 1920s as a means to treat celiac disease. And from there, he kind of furthered the use to other GI disorders, such as inflammatory bowel disease. One of his patients was the daughter of Elaine Gottschall, and her daughter did extremely well on the diet, had improvement of symptoms, and Elaine Gottschall went on to write a book called Breaking the Vicious Cycle, which is more, it kind of popularized the diet from there. So the underlying theory of the diet is that single carbohydrates or simple sugars are easier to digest than more complex carbohydrates that we eat, as they do not overwhelm the inflamed intestine as much. Another theory, again, just speculation, is that food additives, which are all over in our diet presently in convenience foods, food industry, there's over 10,000 food additives in our food supplies presently. These are all excluded on the diet as well, and so we hypothesize that those may play a role also in inflammation. The diet is similar if you've heard of the paleo diet. It eliminates all grains, sugars, aside from honey, and all processed foods. This is kind of a brief overview. As far as allowed foods, fruits and vegetables, meats, mostly organic if able, legumes, and some fermented dairy products are actually what is allowed on the diet.
It's relatively straightforward, it seems. Can you talk a little bit about does the SED work? How do we know that it works?
Great question. There are actually presently limited studies in regards to volume of patients that have actually participated in the diet, as it is challenging in some regards. Here at Seattle Children's, we've had the wonderful opportunity to partner with many families through our research. One retrospective study, so looking back on patients that were on the diet, showed that over 80% of the patients had either resolution of their symptoms or significant improvement of their IBD symptoms. And it's exciting right now. We're actually doing a prospective study with another children's hospital. And at least in our institution, we've enrolled 9 individuals. And one patient ended up dropping out because of his disease severity and also because the diet was pretty stringent for him. But all of the other 8 patients have reached remission within 12 weeks.
Wow, that's really great. Hopefully there will be more promising and interesting studies of the specific carbohydrate diet in the future. And, you know, I think one other thing that we should mention is that, as with all IBD therapies, it's important to identify the ideal patient. So we know that not every therapy is right for every patient. And so through some of the work that you've done, can you talk about who are the ideal patients, who are the right patients for this diet?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. It is what's evolving, I think, how we can kind of identify families, or maybe the families identify themselves that wish to try a diet therapy as opposed to medicine or new medication therapy. We have found that patients with mild to moderate disease usually have more success on the diet. We have not seen the same success as far as reducing inflammation or reversing the extra-intestinal manifestations such as strictures or fistulas or those patients with severe perianal disease, for example. We also have not seen often reversal of growth stunting. So for those patients that have had severe disease and come in and their height has just plateaued for years, we don't tend to see the catch-up rate of linear growth like we do with some of the medications. We also screen kind of for patients that have a really low body mass index, or BMI. If they're already malnourished even or underweight, they are at higher risk being on an exclusion diet that they may lose weight further. And we also look for very motivated families, and families never fail to surprise me, which I love. I've had families start this diet who have never cooked before, who have never done anything but pre-made meals stuck in the oven, and they come out of it cooking and with a kid that's much healthier in many cases. So we also screen for a motivated family, and then one who is more of a selective eater oftentimes has a difficult time on the diet, but it doesn't mean that it cannot be done.
I totally agree. I've had a similar experience. I try to talk about diet with all of my IBD patients and offer dietary therapies when it's appropriate. The families who have come to me interested in a specific carbohydrate diet or who I have suggested the specific carbohydrate diet to, I think one thing, as you know, I think it's really important that the patients follow very closely with a dietitian. And the other thing that I look at is, you know, with any therapy, I think it's important to monitor closely. And if it's not working, we have to move on and find something else that does work. And I think, you know, obviously we want our patients to feel better, and we go by symptoms, but we have to also take into account other things that are more objective. So symptoms, but also looking at the growth, looking at the blood work, stool calprotectin, which is a non-invasive stool test, screening test for gut inflammation. And I think we've talked about before that probably the time frame where you're most likely to see remission and response is somewhere between week 8 and 12, and if it's not working in that time frame, that it's important to move on. You know, I think in terms of how frequently patients should see a dietitian. What do you think about that and other types of monitoring that's required?
Yeah, all great points, Lynn, Dr. Aldenberg. As far as monitoring at Seattle Children's Hospital, the dietitians and actually the doctors follow up pretty regularly at first, every 2 weeks, for weeks 2 and weeks 4, and then we start to space it out, and that's been based off of the research we've done, and we kind of have tailored it to mimic exclusive enteral nutrition in our pathway for that as well. As far as the laboratory monitoring, to add to what you mentioned, is from a nutrition side, we oftentimes look at electrolytes or calcium and vitamin D, and a couple others that we've been looking at in our studies are folic acid, retinol binding protein, and vitamin A.
And Kim, in terms of, you mentioned the different components of the diet and what is allowed and what's not allowed, and it certainly sounds though is on the more restricted side. So in your experience, do patients need to follow this 100%? So do you need to go all out? Is 100% adherence necessary to reach remission?
Since we're kind of at the beginning phases of researching, we do have families follow, patients follow this diet very strictly, as strict as can be based on what we know. But our goal is, because it's such a restrictive diet, we know we want it to be more sustainable long term. I mean, kids are teenagers. They want to live life. They want to be out with their friends. So our goal is, if a kid has reached remission by week 12, based from a laboratory standpoint and a symptom standpoint, we try and add back whole foods, foods that we suspect they may be able to have, like organic rice or oats, or potatoes, and we usually check a stool calprotectin after each food introduction, and we kind of go from there. So we've been successful with cocoa powder, yeast for some kids, potatoes for others. The interesting kind of aspect is not one food works for every kid, though. We've seen a lot of success with several different foods, but some have not responded as well with when potatoes are introduced and others have.
Interesting. And you have just so much experience working with patients and families following this diet, and I'm sure that people who are listening to this podcast will want to know some sort of, you know, tips and tricks and how do you make this work and lessons that you've learned since you began to work with patients who are following this diet.
Mm-hmm. I think our families are the experts for sure, because you have to live and breathe the diet to know the tricks. But some things that I've tried and I've heard from families are cooking foods at home ahead of time. So kind of in advance, batch cooking, so making large amounts of yogurt or of homemade breads, freezing them, having things, maybe your own pre-made quick meals, because there are no prepackaged foods or very limited prepackaged foods that are actually okay on the diet, is key. And meal planning is also essential, so knowing what ingredients you need at the beginning of the week. I think all families should do that, but with this diet, you have to be that much more conscious of meals and meal planning so that you're not out and about without a snack or some meal for your child. Another big one is just collaborating with families that are on the diet, and we have a great support system here in Seattle of families that want to be resources to show families this is how you can start the diet to be more successful. And I think that's huge because they really partner together, and they can totally identify with each other and the experience that they're going through.
Well, great. That's such useful information, Kim. I think, you know, again, this is a therapy that's sort of in its infancy from a scientific perspective. We will certainly learn more and more over the years about, you know, the right patient, how it works, and hopefully have a lot more data that really suggests that it does, in fact, work. And again, I think if this isn't a therapy that you are interested in for your child, it's definitely worth a conversation with your provider. And thanks again, Kim, so much for sharing your knowledge.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
Now let's turn to Giselle Woodward, whose two children and husband all have IBD. Giselle's family follows the specific carbohydrate diet. So Giselle, we've talked a lot about the specific carbohydrate diet, and as someone who has a lot of experience with this, what advice would you give to parents who are interested in pursuing the specific carbohydrate diet for their children or their child?
The first thing I will tell them is to take their time. It is can be overwhelming, the SCD diet, at the beginning. It requires time. It requires planning. But the efforts are totally worth it in the long run. I would recommend them to seek advice from other parents that have done it before. Ask questions as much as you can. Get online. Find groups or others in the community that have done SCD diet and learn from them. And the last thing I would say is really give yourself permission to make mistakes and to learn from the process, because it's a learning process. There's a lot to learn at the beginning, and just to take their time.
Great. And you mentioned planning, and that really seems to be a theme that has come up a few times tonight. So most of the food, it seems like, needs to be prepared at home, and there really are not a lot of packaged options or packaged foods that are recommended. So how does a person make this fit into a busy lifestyle?
Absolutely. The beginning part of SCD is really learning how to cook again, learning new foods, learning how to be learning the intricacy of the diet and what you can eat and not eat. So it is critical to prepare foods at home at the beginning. As you learn, and these emerging markets, is really new products are coming out, but they're far and few between. So learning to read labels and things like that, it is something I will leave for later on in the process. At the beginning, keep your menu simple. Just learn, stick with the basics of eating fruits and vegetables and proteins, and don't try to learn everything and do everything on day one. Because it's, again, the planning is a learning process, and I would consider it more of a process than something you do overnight.
Thanks. That's really great advice. How do you know, it seems like if the child is eating such different food than the other family members that it might make them feel isolated, and I was wondering what your experiences with that were and whether you had all of the family members make dietary modifications. So how do you make sure that the child doesn't feel isolated in this process?
That's a very challenging part. We decided as a family to make a change. And many families that I know, over time, the entire family changes their diet and the diet modification with the sick child. Isolation can be difficult, especially in the teenagers' years. It is something I have dealt with. Teenagers can want to be independent. Education is the most important, I found. Teaching them about foods, having them get involved in the kitchen on preparing foods, it's part of them learning what the right foods are for them. So they need to learn as well as you need to learn. So making be part of the process is very important for children, as I have experiences, especially with teenagers and kids are older and able to be part of the process versus a younger child. So just knowing, staying in touch with your child, talking about it, how they feel school-wise, feeling different, it is part of the diet. But like many other diseases, it is something they need to learn to cope, they need to learn to find their friends, and they need to learn to kind of stand on their own two feet in some ways.
And I'm sure everyone wants to know, and this sort of goes along with that theme, but how do you handle social engagements for a child or for children who are following this diet? So, you know, we know that there are things that will come up, like birthday parties, eating out, sleepovers. How do you incorporate those types of things into your life when you're following a diet that has some, you know, fairly significant restrictions?
Sure, that's a great question and one that is sometimes a challenge. But again, that comes in the planning part of it. We keep like cupcakes that they can eat in the freezer. It's part of the kind of everyday. It's you need to plan ahead. You need to be creative in regards to snacks and cupcakes at school, birthday parties. They need to have their own snack. My kids know and carry their own food. It is kind of part of what they are. It's part of what they do. And also not leaving home without food. We practice runs late, something happens with school, just having that extra snack, extra food in the car, in with you, in your purse, it's very important to keep them from being starving and getting upset and being able to do more spontaneous things. So that's a critical part. Sleepovers is a whole different ballgame. I tend to personally call the family, where they're going, what's going to be the menu. Again, is the planning ahead, trying to make something similar to what they're doing, and trying to integrate it, bring it in as part of, you know, my kids are kids that come with food. It's just kind of part of their being. They're kind of used to it by now.
Wow. Well, as someone who's done this before, your insight is extremely valuable. And it really sounds like from listening to you speak on this that with a little bit of planning and, of course, some creativity, that this is really something that's doable.
Absolutely. And it is definitely doable. It's a matter of a lot of planning, learning, definitely, and finding people that helps you and supports you.
So, Giselle, what I'm interested to know is this effort and all the work that you've put in to incorporate this diet into your lifestyle, has it been worth it?
Absolutely. My daughter, within the first 3 months, she was symptom-free with the diet. She never went on medication. With my son, he grew for the first time in a year and a half after 6 months on the diet. And after 1 year, he had gained 17 pounds. It was completely life-changing for me, totally worth it.
Wow. That's amazing. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode in the podcast series on maintaining healthy nutrition in pediatric IBD patients. For more information, please go to www.gikids.org. I'm Dr. Lindsay Albenberg.